Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers on September the 15th, 2008, which triggered the Wall Street crash, and speak with Jesse Eisinger, the Pulitzer Prize-winning senior reporter at ProPublica, who covers Wall Street and finance. The author of The Chicken Bleep Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. He joins us to explore the paths not taken by President Obama, who bailed out Wall Street in the greatest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the world, in which Wall Street was rewarded for its reckless and criminal behavior, and Main Street got stuck with the bill. We will discuss the extent to which the economic crisis of 2007 to 2012 morphed into the political and geopolitical crisis of today as the unfairness of the 1% stiffing the 99% aroused right-wing nationalism both in the United States and Europe and helped install Donald Trump in the White House. Unfortunately, instead of a backlash of social justice, populist anger was cynically captured by a con man who used the rage and alienation to gain power, then screw his voters to reward the super-rich in the upper echelons of the Forbes list of billionaires, an exclusive club which Trump has always so desperately aspired to join. Then, with Hurricane Florence striking North Carolina, we'll examine an aspect of the damage from flooding which does not get the attention it deserves in spite of the devastating experiences from prior hurricanes. Matthew Starr, who works with the Noose Riverkeeper Foundation in North Carolina on their Muddy Water Watch program, joins us to discuss how there are 62 industrial swine operations within the 100-year floodplain, with 366 within 100 feet of the floodplain. This means these vast so-called lagoons filled with pig feces and urine will be flooded, and the contamination will spread into the rivers and streams, polluting vast swaths of the state. Then finally, with Wednesday's certification to Congress by Secretary of State Pompeo that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have shown, quote, demonstrable actions to limit civilian casualties in their war on Yemen, we will speak with Kate Gould, the Legislative Director for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, the Quaker lobby in the public interest fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She joins us to discuss how much the U.S. has blood on its hands from providing the Saudis with refueling, intelligence, and targeting in a war the UN describes as causing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And joining us now is Jesse Eisinger, who is a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section, and in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. And his latest book is The Chicken Bleep Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Eisinger.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there was an op-ed in the New York Times by Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and Hank Paulson, or the three pillars, if you will, of the so-called recovery from the Wall Street crash. One was head of the New York Fed, the other head of the Fed, and the other one Secretary of the Treasury. But they're arguing essentially that the main problem we have now is there's an insufficient authority to bail out banks in the future. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary, don't you think?
Well, yes and no. We do want the Fed to be the lender of last resort and have extraordinary powers in a financial crisis. I take issue not with the Fed's actions, which have been curtailed by Dodd-Frank, but with the fact that in some ways the Fed didn't go too far enough. Geithner and Bernanke and Paulson and later the Obama administration were reluctant to do what I think they should have done, which were really three things. One is take more control of the financial system, perhaps taking control of banks temporarily, wiping out management, wiping out bondholders. That would be one. Another would be a much greater degree of economic stimulus. particularly focused on homeowners, and the third is holding bankers accountable for their actions, including prison where warranted. Those are the three failures, but I don't think the Fed's extraordinary lending was one of them. I think that was a success.
But in the broader sense, looking back and on Saturday, the 10th anniversary, September the 15th, of Lehman Brothers going under, which triggered the crash, it was nevertheless the biggest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the world. And was there a path not taken? Because if you go back to Roosevelt and the Great Depression under Herbert Hoover, Roosevelt was elected, but in the interregnum between the time he was elected and the time he was inaugurated, Hoover was begging FDR to help him out. And FDR didn't want to help him out as the Depression worsened, simply because he wanted a clean slate and he didn't want to be tainted by the mistakes of his predecessor. Well, the crash happened essentially on Bush's watch. Why did Obama take it on? Why did he not basically hold the banks responsible for their recklessness?
Well, you're talking about letting institutions fail having a collapse of their stock prices. Their stock prices would have been wiped out. Their bond prices would have collapsed. That would have had cascading losses throughout the financial system. And that would have been even more catastrophic for homeowners and consumers and individual citizens. You know, that's I think that one possibility that of a path not taken is a kind of the Andrew Mellon argument from the Great Depression: liquidate, 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 let everything fail and reset. And I think in a panic that would have caused unnecessary losses. So I think there was another path not taken, which was that the failing was to confuse saving the financial system with saving specific institutions. And I think that they could have saved the financial system without prioritizing saving Citigroup as it existed then, or saving J.P. Morgan, or saving Goldman Sachs. All of those financial institutions were on the brink and probably would have failed had it not been for government intervention. And so what I think you should do then is wipe out management. Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, they lose their jobs. The Citigroup board of directors has to resign. The government may take them over temporarily, and bondholders take a smaller loss because the government is there. And then the government turns around and sells it to the public again with new management in 6 months, a year, 2 years, something like that. I think that would have been a more equitable solution that would have protected the public fisc, but also protected non-shareholders, non-bondholders, homeowners, and average citizens who don't have wealth tied up in the markets, but who are very vulnerable to the economic fallout from this financial crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who is a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section, and in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. And his latest book is The Chicken Bleep Club: Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. So, having talked about the paths not taken, there's a couple of interesting books out now that are looking at the very nature of American capitalism. There's the book by the Columbia economist Adam Tooze, Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crisis Changed the World. He's arguing, in effect, that the handling of the crisis, in the sense that, as I mentioned, this vast transfer of private debt into public debt, and the extent to which Main Street bailed out Wall Street, but Wall Street is now thriving and Main Street is languishing. Adam Tooze talks about the financial and economic crisis morphing into what we have now with Donald Trump and this alienated kind of base of his that somehow, you know, in their bones they're angry about what happened. But of course, rather than take a meaningful populist route to help people, ironically, they've backed a billionaire who's only helping billionaires.
Yes, and a nationalist, a xenophobe, that we have the worst kind of populism rising, nativism, and we're flirting with authoritarianism. So, yes, I agree with the Tu's argument that the financial crisis morphed into a political crisis, not just in the United States, but across Europe as well. And I think this was mainly for two reasons that I mentioned earlier, but I can elaborate on, which is that after saving the financial system and unfortunately prioritizing institutions and bankers rather than the financial system itself, the Obama administration failed to adequately bail out or protect homeowners. They had programs to aid homeowners, but they were woefully inadequate, and they were paralyzed by the politics of it. They didn't want to be seen as bailing out neighbors who had renovated their kitchens punishing those who hadn't or rewarding those people who had been reckless. But I think that was a severe, terrible mistake and gave rise to terrible resentment. I also think that failing to hold bankers accountable, which should have included prosecutions. We only prosecuted one mid-level banker for crimes committed in the financial crisis, and that's what my book is about. And I think that was a great scandal of the Obama administration. Those two things, a failure to really help the average person, particularly who was losing his or her home, and failing to hold the powerful accountable, undermined our democracy. It made people furious, justifiably furious, and undermined the legitimacy of the reform effort. So we have Dodd-Frank, but people don't believe that it was effective. And so I think that contributed to Trump's rise indisputably. And people were very angry, and this rage was inchoate and unfocused. And Trump was able to channel it, and Hillary Clinton, somewhat unfairly, somewhat fairly, was the avatar of Obama and this failure and this institutional and establishment failure to help average people. And so he was able to prevail.
Well, it does feel like, though, in the context of helping out Main Street as opposed to Wall Street and not addressing the needs of the homeowners who were the ones that got fleeced in the first place from these sort of what are called liar's loans, which were packaged into securities, and then the whole thing became a Ponzi scheme, in effect. I would make the case the exemplar of this unfairness is our own Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who seems to be the epitome of vulture capitalism. He became rich as a result of predatory buying up and essentially creating fraudulent documents to force people out of their homes. He was the foreclosure king out here in Pasadena.
He was indeed. Writ large, the Trump administration, Donald Trump has perpetrated an enormous con on the American people. He said he was going to be a fighter for the average man, and he turned around and he installed Goldman Sachs executives in his cabinet and hedge fund managers and billionaires, and they've set us about cutting taxes for the wealthy, massive deregulation, especially for the financial sector that had just been blown up the entire economy, and then worse, crony capitalism and corruption and conflicts of interest that are rife in this administration. So it is shocking and appalling that they're able to perpetrate this all under the auspices of governing for the forgotten man. It's breathtaking that this is happening in the country, and Mnuchin is certainly part of this whole process, but only a small part. I mean, Donald Trump is the one who's continuing to run his business and marketing and profiting from the presidency while in office.
Not to mention his son-in-law as well, Jared Kushner.
Exactly.
Who in Woodward's new book, apparently there was a great deal of concern within the administration about his business dealings and the mixing geopolitics with business with the Saudis and the Qataris, etc. But I find, though, just in referring to Woodward's book, one of the main sources apparently is Gary Cohn, who got the big $1.5 trillion tax break for the ultra-wealthy and then left. And now he's the source of one of the sources trashing Trump. That strikes me as a little hypocritical, shall we say.
Well, just just a tad. You know, Gary Cohn had to come back to New York and enter Manhattan society. And I think he's made a calculated decision that after having worked in the Trump administration, that the only viable path, only acceptable path to being rehabilitating himself is to trash Trump. Though he wasn't trashing Trump while he was giving him economic advice and while he got the tax cut for the wealthy passed. So it's pretty audacious. And I think Woodward's book shows that it's somewhat successful, that the reviews of it show that Woodward depicted him as the moral conscience of the moral center, I think, is one review called him, of the Trump administration, which, you know, that's a low bar, but I think it's unwarranted for Gary Cohn. So, you know, he's on a rehabilitation mission, and it's somewhat successful. People's memories are very short, and people don't pay attention to detail. If it is successful, you know, that'll be a spectacular PR victory for someone who I don't think deserves it.
Well, but the people that he gave this $1.5 trillion gift to, they don't need it. I mean, that tax break for this ultra wealthy makes no sense. And when you consider the long-term damage it does to our kids and grandkids and how this deficit's going to balloon like crazy, I think history's going to really nail him.
Perhaps. You know, it's giving a little short-term stimulus to the economy, which they're happy with, and it's lining their pocketbooks, which they're really happy with. It is terrible policy. It is not an effective long-term economic stimulus. It was not necessary, and it is putting ourselves in a fiscal hole. So I agree that this is not a great policy. The reason why it was done is that the wealthy don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to fund public services in this country, and we are in desperate need of a stronger social safety net. We have massive infrastructure shortfalls that we could be funding with tax dollars. So this was the wrong policy, but it was clearly the major policy priority of the Republican Party and of the Gary Cohn class of Republicans, and they are willing to set aside any qualms that they have about Donald Trump, including his willingness to foment war and destabilize the world in order to get a tax cut. And history should pass judgment on that.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jesse Eisinger, the other book that I wanted to mention to you is The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies and the Death of Competition by Jonathan Tepper and Denise Hearn. That is getting some interesting reviews. I haven't had a chance yet to talk to the authors, but it basically deals with the big questions of why the U.S. is becoming a more unequal society and why its economic growth is anemic despite trillions of dollars of federal debt and money printing, and why the number of startups has declined and why workers are losing out. And it essentially, mm-hmm. it essentially nails these new monopolies like Google and Facebook and particularly Amazon. And, of course, Jonathan Taplin wrote a book about that earlier and the whole idea of surveillance capitalism. Is there a slow wake-up going on here? The word antitrust is starting to emerge more often.
Yeah, I haven't read this new book, but it is very interesting that antitrust has gotten a little bit of political currency, and I think it's warranted. I think that we have a overly concentrated economy, and corporate power is at a zenith, and it's distorting our politics and our economy. And I think we have to be very concerned with the way that these companies are wielding their power and influence. And I think it's clearly, there's a lot of evidence that it's stifling innovation. There's not a lot of startup activity. I think it's constraining wages because these companies have monopsony power. They are the sole purchasers of labor, and so they can keep wages down. And, you know, and then they're curtailing our discourse. If you look at Facebook's power or Amazon's power over books, that's mighty indeed and severely worrisome for a healthy democracy. So I think there is a wake-up call. It's fairly narrow now. I think it's really kind of only on the left of the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Warren has embraced it, but I don't think it's really even that mainstream in the Democratic Party. And there are pockets of fellow travelers on the right and in conservative circles who could embrace it, and here and there thinkers have, but it really doesn't have any currency in the modern Republican Party today. So is this going to be something that's a political power, powerful force? Could be. Depends sort of on the midterms and depends on the 2020 election. There's a lot of talk about it.
Well, Jesse, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate just getting this kind of update on 10 years on Saturday from the Wall Street, or the beginning of the Wall Street crash.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section, and in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. And his latest book is The Chicken Bleep Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into an aspect of the damage from the flooding from Hurricane Florence, which will mean that these lagoons filled with pig feces and urine will be flooded, and the contamination will spread into the rivers and streams, polluting vast swaths of North Carolina.
Been a crash on the levee, and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king, and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Whoa, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matthew Starr, who works with the Noose River Keeper Foundation in North Carolina on their Muddy Water Watch program, and previously was a program coordinator responsible for organizing Noose River cleanups. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Starr.
Thank you for having me.
And Matthew, you are in North Carolina, in Raleigh, in the center of the state, as the hurricane approaches. But there's one aspect of the story, of course, that's not getting a lot of attention with most of the coverage, and that is what the impact will be of this hurricane, and particularly the massive amount of rain it will bring, on these 62 industrial swine operations or pig farms within the state's 100-year floodplain. So you've got, what, about 250,000 hogs, and you've got these so-called lagoons, 166 of them, and another 366 within 100 feet of the floodplain. And then on top of that, you've got these industrial poultry operations housing more than 1.8 million chickens. So all of the waste from the chickens and the hogs is likely or liable, is it not, to get into the rivers and streams, and in particular, of course, the Noose River. What's your prediction here?
So, you know, we're really concerned about those 62 industrial swine facilities that are located in the 100-year floodplain, meaning those are the most vulnerable facilities to a storm such as this magnitude. They are those most at risk to flooding and to spilling the contents from their cesspools into our public waterways. And so while I can tell you that there are 62 of these swine facilities, now, you know, these are gigantic facilities. These are not mom and pop operations. These are industrial scale operations. While I can tell you that there are 62 of these swine facilities, I can't tell you how many of the poultry facilities there are in the 100-year floodplain, and that's also very concerning. I can't tell you that because they're what's called deemed permitted, meaning that these facilities, when they're built in North Carolina, do not have to file a permit with our Department of Environmental Quality. And, you know, that's really concerning because these are public trust waterways. Our, you know, our rivers and our streams aren't owned by industry. They're not owned by the government. They're owned by North Carolinians. And it's very concerning that we don't know where they're located. And 2 years ago, during Hurricane Matthew, we documented numerous industrial swine and poultry facilities that flooded during Hurricane Matthew. And we're expecting Florence to equal, if not surpass, the impact of Hurricane Matthew. And not a single swine facility has been removed in the 2 years since Hurricane Matthew, which is really disheartening, and should be concerning for all North Carolinians.
But so you're expecting severe flooding in the Noose and Cape Fear River basins, right? And
correct.
These so-called lagoons, they're filled with millions of gallons of hog feces and urine, and they're very close to the water level at any rate. So there's only a few feet there, or not, I don't know what the amount of rain would require for them to spill into the waterways. But if it happened a couple of years ago, and this storm looks like it's a lot worse than the last one, this is all but inevitable, is it not, that you're going to have massive pollution? And what are the consequences of all of this pig and poultry waste in the waterways? I mean, that sounds like a recipe for a lot of epidemics.
Yeah, so obviously we're concerned on this on an environmental level, and just the threat that these facilities pose to fishable, swimmable, drinkable water, which as the Upper Noose Riverkeeper, I'm advocating for every day. But these facilities also pose a very real human health risk and a risk to the communities in which they're located. Floodwaters obviously have many harmful contaminants in them just from the nature of a large storm event or flood event. However, we shouldn't allow facilities in the 100-year floodplain that pose such a risk to our environment and our communities, knowing that more than likely those facilities will be impacted when a storm such as Hurricane Florence comes. And with climate change, we know that they're getting bigger, they're getting more destructive, and they're carrying with them more rain. And so 2 years after Hurricane Matthew, which was a major storm in eastern North Carolina, to not have done anything in that two-year period to ensure North Carolinians that we are removing, we being the state of North Carolina, are removing or buying out some of these facilities to lessen that impact is really quite sad.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Starr, who works with the Noose Riverkeeper Foundation in North Carolina on their Muddy Water Watch program, and previously as a program coordinator responsible for organizing the Noose River cleanups. And we're talking about these industrial factory farms with vast lagoons, millions of gallons of hog feces and urine, along with cesspools or lagoons with chicken feces as well. Now, I imagine Smithfield, which is the big pork monopoly, they're a powerful political player, right, in the state of North Carolina. Is that why? Is that why these lagoons, after the last hurricane, where you had the contamination of the waterways in North Carolina, they weren't moved? Why? Because Smithfield is lobbied against them? What was the impediment to preventing this horrible environmental catastrophe from happening again, which is likely to happen in the next couple of days?
So in the late 1990s, we had a hurricane, in 1999, Hurricane Floyd. And after Hurricane Floyd, our state appropriated nearly $20 million to buy out many of the swine facilities in the 100-year floodplain. And after Hurricane Matthew, they only appropriated a couple million dollars. And that is because many of our legislators are in the pocket of the industry leaders, Smithfield Foods, the North Carolina Pork Council, and the North Carolina Farm Bureau. And so right now, Smithfield Foods is doing the absolute cheapest thing they can do in handling the waste, which is storing it in unlined open-air cesspools and then spraying that raw feces, manure, and everything else that's associated with that comes out of a hog onto the land. And that's all they're doing. And that is the absolute cheapest thing they could do. And so they have contributed just a ton of money to North Carolina politicians to ensure that they are not held responsible.
And when you talk about politicians, is this across the board, both Democrat and Republican?
We've found that it does include some Democrats, but most of the large funding has been given to members of the GOP.
So tell me about, apart from the work that you do, you're obviously on the case, Matthew. Are the public aware of this? I mean, they've got to be upset. I mean, not only are they in danger from the hurricane itself, but the aftermath of the hurricane, of having contaminated water from which they may well get sick, that you'd think would get people's attention.
Yeah, you would think. So, you know, North Carolina is a true purple state. During the last election, we elected a Democratic governor, and our state voted for Trump. So, yes, I would say that the majority of North Carolinians are upset that this source of pollution is continued to allow to exist in eastern North Carolina without much being done. However, the representation of legislative members from eastern North Carolina are those same members that we know have been given large donations from the industry and continue to shield them through legislative actions for environmental regulations, as well as shielding them from being held responsible when their neighbors try to seek remedies.
So what's your expectation then? If it was bad the last time around with Hurricane Matthew, and now you got Florence, which looks like it's worse, you're in Raleigh, which is what pretty much in the center of the state. At this point, mm-hmm. What does it look like outside your window?
So rain has picked up pretty steadily since we've been on the phone. And, we're expecting the rain to continue. We're expecting just a tremendous amount of rain with this storm. And the further east you go, the more rain we're expecting. And the impact that this will have on the industrial swine and poultry facility, if everything holds true with the forecast, will be tremendous. And we hope that this is another eye-opening experience that will force our state to take action to remove these continuous threats from the environment and the communities of eastern North Carolina.
So are you saying that between you and Raleigh and the coast where the hurricane is about to strike, that these facilities are to the east of you, where...
Correct.
So that's where the impact's going to be a lot worse, right?
Yes, sir. Yes. If the models hold true, the worst impacts will happen where the majority of these facilities are located.
And in where you are in Raleigh, I imagine you have refugees, do you not, from east?
Yes, correct. We've had... Most of the counties in eastern North Carolina and all the beaches have been evacuated, most of them under mandatory evacuation. So we've got lots of shelters set up throughout Wake County, where City of Raleigh is, that are housing those community members and just, trying to lend a helping hand. You're seeing a lot of schools and churches and public entities offering refuge for those community members coming from the east.
Well, just in closing, the hogs themselves in these pig factory farms, are they likely to be drowned or inundated? Are they on higher ground than the lagoons with all their waste?
Some of them are. However, with a storm such as this, we would expect to see some mortality. We have heard that the industry is removing their commodity being the hogs, from low-lying areas. However, that doesn't remove the raw waste that's on site. So, of course, Smithfield Foods is looking after their profit while they're leaving the threat of the raw waste on site.
Well, Matthew Starr, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. And, you know, thank you very much for caring what's happening on the other side of the country.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Starr, who works with the Noose Riverkeeper Foundation in North Carolina on their Muddy Water Watch program. And previously, he was a program coordinator responsible for organizing the Noose River cleanups. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Wednesday's certification by Secretary of State Pompeo that the Saudis are showing demonstrable actions limiting civilian casualties in their war in Yemen, which flies in the face of all evidence.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Like a dog without a bone, and packed her out alone. Riders on the storm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kate Gould, the Legislative Director for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and the Israel-Palestine peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me back.
And Kate, the Trump administration met the congressional deadline Wednesday last night. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo certified to Congress that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had shown, quote, demonstrable actions to limit casualties in their campaign against Yemen's Houthi rebels. This is not being met with a lot of enthusiasm by very many people, because it feels like a fig leaf on a humanitarian catastrophe. And certainly the UN is not buying it. The idea that the Saudi coalition is protecting civilians in Yemen, it flies in the face of all the evidence. So what do you make of this, what seems like a rather disgracefully hypocritical situation?
Very much so. And we're seeing that the certification was clearly given in a very cynical way in certifying that the Saudi Arabia and the UAE are undertaking demonstrable actions to reduce the harm to civilians and civilian infrastructure. I mean, that that flies in the face of all evidence to the contrary. We've recently seen Saudi Arabia bomb a school bus full of children in broad daylight in a crowded market. We've seen these attacks on IDPs, on Yemenis literally fleeing bombing of other areas for safe havens and then being bombed repeatedly and killing more children that way. There have been more attacks on schools and hospitals. There was an attack not long ago in a cholera treatment facility. So we've seen these indiscriminate assaults on civilians and civilian targets. There is no evidence that any of that has reduced. In fact, all evidence points to the continued upward tempo of those attacks. And so the certification certainly has been used as a fig leaf, and it's really the administration just showing that they are determined to double down on providing support to aid and abet Saudi war crimes in Yemen.
Well, Senator Jeanne Shaheen and Republican Senator Todd Young, they have basically, well, they've submitted a letter to the administration saying a major contributor to the devastation and chaos is the indiscriminate bombing campaign led by a coalition made up of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which receives refueling, intelligence, and targeting support from the United States. So if the United States is helping Saudi Arabia target in Yemen and they're blowing up school buses full of kids in a market, then the U.S. has bloods on its hands, does it not?
Very much so. The U.S. is complicit in so many ways. And as you mentioned, yes, the U.S. is providing intel support and also is literally fueling these bombers that are in the air. I mean, these are U.S.-made bombers that are dropping U.S.-made bombs that are fueled by these, by U.S. personnel that are actually manning these gas stations in the sky. That way, when the Saudi bombers are dropping these bombs on Yemeni civilians, they don't even have to ground their planes to continue the assaults. They can just hover in the air. They can just, get refueled and then continue their bombing runs. So at every step in the process, the U.S. definitely is complicit. I mean, all but actually pulling the trigger and dropping the bomb itself. But at every stage along the way, the U.S. is complicit. And perhaps actually the most the way that is most damaging is really the diplomatic support that the United States gives for this war to continue. And the Saudis and the Emiratis continually cite that as that the U.S. gives them legitimacy to continue this war. And that's the real danger. That's one of the dangers of the Pompeo certification, is that you're seeing yet again another demonstration, another sign to the world that U.S. support for this war is unconditional. Now, that's the signal that the administration is sending. You are hearing a very different tune from Congress. And yes, this is, the State Department didn't want to do this certification at all. In fact, there was a lot of pushback in when Trump signed the NDAA, the big Pentagon spending bill over the summer. Then he actually called out, focused on this provision as one that he didn't see as an essential requirement for the administration to follow through on. So there was real question about whether they would. They eventually did, by Pompeo issuing this certification. But then you hear, including some of the authors of this legislation. So we hear from, Senator Shaheen, who said that my legislation with Senator Young established firm benchmarks on avoiding civilian casualties before certification could be made by the administration. The coalition hasn't met these goals, and it is evident that the administration is deliberately sidestepping congressional oversight. So we've seen a lot of, a lot of momentum in Congress and a lot of building momentum for real accountability and to rein in U.S. support for this war. And I think we're only going to see more of that in the days and weeks to come.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who is the Legislative Director for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and she lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace. Now, Kate, I mentioned earlier that this is very hypocritical. And what I mean by that is that the U.S. is refusing to certify that Iran is complying with the nuclear deal, which the U.N. says it is. At the same time, it certifies the Saudi-led coalition who are killing civilians, and we're basically saying that they're not doing that, or at least they're taking care not to do it. So to my sense, this is all about Trump and his relationship with the Saudi royals, and particularly MBS. Because remember, they faded him. He did the sword dance. He saw all the gold. He couldn't believe. He's got all that fake gold in Trump Tower, and they had all this real gold all over the place, and he was totally blown away. And even though so much focus in the press and with the Mueller investigation, as much as we know about it, is on the extent to which the Russians both meddled in the elections and possibly financed Trump and the Republicans. They certainly, a lot of evidence that the Russians have been financing people like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan for some time, which may explain their disgraceful position on what's going on in terms of Russian meddling. But there are reports that there's an equal possibility, if not a probability, that there was just as much Saudi and UAE money that flowed into the 2016 elections to help Trump as there were from Russia. So to my mind, that's how it is. Our foreign policy is dictated by a president who, if you criticize him, he calls you the most horrible names and is absolutely venal and vicious in his attacks. But if you flatter him, then he just absolutely, you have him eating out of your hand like Kim Jong-un does and the Saudis do. So is that what it really is about? You know, it's like the Saudis, the good guys, the Iranians are the bad guys. It's that simple.
Well, we did see that Trump's very first foreign trip was to Saudi Arabia, of course, when there was that whole orb sword dance situation. And then, you know, more recently, yeah, I mean, as you pointed out, there's a number of reports of these kinds of gifts, this kind of undue influence that Saudi Arabia is having on the Trump administration. We know that the Trump hotel saw a 13% increase in rental revenue in the first 3 months of this year after several people accompanying Mohammed bin Salman stayed for days, you know, there in March. And, you know, we've just seen a lot of the Trump Hotel in New York really get a huge revenue boost from MBS's entourage. So it's really been, there's been a lot of concerns about what this means as far as, you know, claims that that Trump may be violating the Constitution's Emoluments Clause by accepting, you know, business payments from foreign governments. So I think that there's certainly, a number of reports of those, you know, that kind. What we're seeing is that, yeah, and as far as foreign policy matters are concerned, that that in general we've seen this blank check toward, you know, given to Saudi Arabia for waging this horrific war that's plunged Yemen into the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The UN is even predicting that 18 million people could be one step away from starvation by the end of this year if there isn't a real change. So it's had, you know, horrific consequences. And we've seen, you know, pretty much unconditional support. Now, that said, there have been, you know, even last year in December, Trump did call on Saudi Arabia to end the blockade on Yemen, reportedly after he had seen some of the photos, really the photos of children starving to death in Yemen, and that made an impact. And I think that there really, I mean, there is this opportunity with Congress pushing hard to try to change the administration's approach. You know, we've seen, so that there's been a lot of congressional activity around this over the past few weeks. And you know, as I mentioned, I mean, I think there's going to be more. We now, so, you know, and we talked about the Shaheen Young legislation, that was bipartisan legislation. It was Young is a Republican in the, you know, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and then Shaheen, the Democrat, and then they got support, or they passed this through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with bipartisan support. And then we've seen, you know, we've seen other Republicans actually support efforts to end all U.S. military support for the war entirely. And, you know, I do want to flag for listeners that we've heard some dramatic news last week that Congressman Adam Smith, who's the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, so he'd be positioned to be chair as the House flips under control of Democrats. He is moving forward with legislation with Congressman Ro Khanna from the Bay Area, from Silicon Valley, to moving forward with a resolution endorsing the War Powers resolution that would, invoking the War Powers resolution that would then end all U.S. military support for the war in Yemen. It would highlight that this is a war not only, you know, absolutely devastating, it's never been authorized by Congress. Congress has never weighed in on this. It hasn't had a vote on this under the Obama administration and hasn't done so under the Trump administration. And we're seeing support from a number of Republicans as well that are really concerned about the fact that this war is waging and the U.S. is so deeply implicated despite never having voted on it. So this legislation is expected to be introduced very soon, and we expecting to see a vote before the end of the year. And then also, Trump is after that whole Orb affair, and then again when MBS came to the White House and they were negotiating different arms deals, he's been talking about moving forward with billions of dollars of arms deals, and one piece of that are more bombs for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to wage this horrific war in Yemen, and we're seeing a lot of interest in Congress in actually blocking those bombs from going forward.
Well, you have to add to the list of chicanery and subterfuge flows of money into the Trump campaign and into Republican coffers from Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Also, in Bob Woodward's new book, Fear, there's quite a lot of references to concerns within the administration itself about Jared Kushner's financial deals to get him bailed out from a bad investment at 666 Fifth Avenue. And apparently that was the reason why they pulled his security clearance. So that's a whole other story as well. And then the other thing that's really, I think, really shocking is that, as you know, Kate Gould, Al-Qaeda is an enemy of the United States. They were behind 9/11, which we had the 17th anniversary of that horrific attack on the United States. And we now learn from the Associated Press that the Saudi coalition has been paying al-Qaeda commanders to leave key cities and towns while letting others retreat with weapons, equipment, and wads of looted cash. So what's going on there? Why are our allies paying footsie with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who are the enemy of the United States?
That's right, yes. Well, very good question. And we're finally starting to see Congress really push those questions. We did see a letter from 30 Democrats that highlighted that AP report that, you know, as you say, I mean, we've seen both, there are reports of both the UAE and Saudi Arabia, paying out these al-Qaeda fighters. And it's not even just a recent phenomenon, but that there have been reports of this going on for years, some kind of support for al-Qaeda in, over the last several years, and no accountability for that. I think most Americans, I mean, don't have any idea that the U.S. is waging war in Yemen, and that many who do only know about the U.S. waging war against al-Qaeda and the drone strikes that, of course, that are intended ostensibly to be against al-Qaeda, and then often are still killing civilians. But then most Americans have no concept of how we're waging this other war. We're actually propping up the Saudis on the same side of the war with al-Qaeda, on their very same side, that the al-Qaeda is actually fighting the Houthis just like Saudi Arabia is. So it's really just a devastating situation. I mean, we've also seen the, U.S. intelligence community conclude that the longer this war goes on, the longer the Saudi war goes on, then the more that has emboldened and empowered al-Qaeda. And certainly we've seen, I mean, that's just borne out by the duration of the war, that al-Qaeda has become more powerful. So it's a devastating war that, Yemenis are paying the highest price, but certainly it's making the world as a whole less safe, and it's making Americans less safe.
And this is the poorest country in the Middle East, Yemen, and it's always had a food and water shortage, but now it's been under a very, very ruthless blockade.
Right.
And they're still blockading that Yemeni port to the point where the UN is warning about mass starvation. So just in the short term, this is going to continue, right? This is an impetuous war started by Mohammed bin Salman, who, needless to say, a lot of gullible U.S. reporters have hailed him as a reformer. But he went into this recklessly and arrogantly without an end game. And there is an end game, as far as I can tell, just more slaughter.
Yes, more slaughter, more starvation. But Americans really have a key role to play here. I mean, we are complicit in this, and that also means, you know, we have some responsibility and we also have some power, and our lawmakers have real power in this. This is something where Congress can make a fuss and it can make real, make a real impact. I mean, I think this certification highlights how, because what it meant, the certification provision is that if Pompeo wasn't able to certify that the Saudis had changed their behavior, had minimized civilian casualties and such, then the U.S. would have to stop all fueling of their bombers as they rain down, you know, these bombs on civilians. And of course, the administration wanted to continue, sending, refueling these bombers. And so they decided to go ahead and certify it. But that just highlights that, okay, so these certifications, that's not enough. And Congress is going to have to take the next step and actually cut off all support for this war. And we really have an opportunity here. We're expecting that... and this will probably happen after the elections, but that, you know, that's not that long away. So we're expecting that likely in November or so, that we're going to see the Trump administration notify these major bomb sales, perhaps 3 years worth of bombs to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And then we're expecting that there's going to be a senator who will introduce legislation to block the bomb sales. And then the Senate will actually get to vote on this. And last year we had a vote. 47 senators voted to block bombs to Saudi Arabia. That's only 4 short of the votes that we need to win. So, and that was a year ago. That was before the bus bombing. That was before a lot of these horrific attacks that have gotten more media coverage, lately. So also at that time, a lot of senators said, look, we're going to give Saudi Arabia one more chance. They said they're going to minimize civilian casualties. We're going to, let them have one more go at it. And then we're going to really, call the shots on this and hold them accountable. So this is the time for accountability. I mean, this is the time not just for accountability, this is the time to end all support for the war. And we could win that vote, and that would be unprecedented. I mean, that would be the first time that this kind of, bomb sale would be blocked, legislation to block a bomb sale would be passed in the Senate floor. We also have to put the pressure on to get the House to actually take this up on the floor. Under this kind of momentum, and if people keep up the pressure, and I'm certainly hearing, I've heard from members of Congress and from Hill staff often that they're really surprised about how they are hearing from constituents. They're hearing about this. They heard about this over the recess in town hall meetings. People were asking them questions about Yemen. It's finally getting on people's radar, and now we do have it on. It's been featured on cable news channels and such. So more Americans are hearing about it, and this is really a time to just keep up the momentum and ask members of Congress to speak out. And since most of your listeners are probably in California, I just feel like Senator Feinstein actually wrote a great letter to the editor in the Washington Post. And even, so before there's legislation, she's already said, look, I'm going to oppose these bomb sales and we need to end support for this war. So we want other senators to follow suit. We want Senator Harris. We want, every senator to speak out against these bomb sales going forward.
Okay, Gould, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's the Legislative Director for the Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and she lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.